south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
Here's a question people always ask. Which Latin countries have the best and worst roads? Well, turns out the best roads are in big cities and inter-province, state, or country highways that have been financed by something like a World Bank loan, or some idiot first world country like Japan or the US who's made a loan to a third world Latin American country. Because you see, with big money infrastructure loans coming from first world outfits, they'll generally oversee the selection of the contractors, so the donating country gets a big chunk of that money back. And first world international contractors means first world style inspections too. So you get a bit of the good with the bad. That's why, for example, if you're driving from Texas through Mexico down to Guatemala, Salvador, whatever, you'll hit some really great stretches of concrete road. Then all of a sudden, you're in a dusty, busted up road in the bush like you're on safari. Just doesn't make sense. Until you check out where the finances came from. So as a rule in Latin America, when you see really good concrete roads, there's some first world foreign money, IMF loans, or World Bank loans involved in the project. Oh, and another thing you'll notice, when you're driving through one of the really nice neighborhoods in any Latin American city, and they all have very nice neighborhoods, you'll see some very good roads. Because you see, everywhere malignant pus bag politicians roam and live, the roads will be excellent. But I guess that's true up in the States, too. If you don't believe that, just have a look at where the nicest roads are in Washington, D.C. But speaking in generalities, what Latin countries have the best and worst roads? Can you guess? Think about it for a second and see if you're right. In terms of quality, you have to wonder how can you even measure that, because when you're way out in the boonies, oftentimes you'll be on a really crappy dirt road with a million potholes in it. And that's, again, one big reason why you don't want to be driving around at night. And it's just as likely you could be on a very nice concrete road on the way to an international airport and hit a pothole that wipes out your car's front end. Yep, Latin America is a land of extremes. Get used to it. Well, here's what you didn't know. There's an international outfit called the Global Competitive Index. They measure a number of characteristics for 140 different countries in the world. And one of the things they measure is the quality and quantity of roads and infrastructure. So every year they put out a report, and I haven't put much faith in it because I know how the roads are down here. How they make them, maintain them, insert laugh track here, and how they hand out the contracts. For example, a big road project might be announced. It doesn't get started for a year and a half, and it takes 5 years to complete altogether. So you got 5 years of terrible traffic. Then, when it's done, traffic moves fast, the road's in great shape for a year or two, and then it crumbles. Lack of maintenance and quality control are two chronic illnesses of Latin America. And even when a crack first world international company comes in and builds roads and bridges, when it's done, they leave. And then the local corrupt shit for brains politicians are forever after in charge of upkeep and maintenance. Insert laugh track here, too. So anyway, once again, the Worldwide Road and Infrastructure Report has come out. And for a change, this year's report I'm really paying attention to, because this time they've done it in a different manner that really makes sense. Listen to this. I'll quote a guy who's responsible for part of this report as he explains in an interview to Costa Rica's La Nación newspaper. In Spanish, of course, he says, and I'll translate, "This is the very first time our report includes the connectivity indicator, we call it. It's a measure of how long it takes drivers to get from one place to another versus how long that trip should take in moderate traffic if the road was in A1 condition. Meanwhile, we've distributed surveys in the productive sector of each country asking business owners in a private sector about the conditions of their roads. Turns out, in South America, the worst roads, Venezuela, Paraguay, Guyana, and French Guiana, followed by Brazil and Uruguay. The best roads in South America, Chile, Colombia, and Peru, with Ecuador, Argentina, and Bolivia right in the middle. All right, that's for South America. Now, Central America. From best to worst roads, Number 1, Dominican Republic. Number 2, El Salvador. 3, Panama. Nicaragua, 4. Right in the middle, Mexico, heading toward the bottom, Honduras. With Costa Rica and Guatemala tied for second last place. And the worst roads in Central America? Belize. Now, the big surprise here is how bad the infrastructure is in Costa Rica, since that's where all the tourist dollars are. It doesn't make sense. It's got the highest cost of living, the highest taxes, the highest number and cost of transit fines in all of Latin America, and those fines are supposed to go for roads and infrastructure, the highest percentage of government debt in all of Latin America, and the largest government bureaucracy per capita in all of Latin America, too. So then, why is it rated second last place for infrastructure and roads? By the way, we left out Cuba here because most of the roads in the boonies in Cuba are gravel and dirt. And less than 1% of people own their own cars. Anyway, to explain the bad roads in Costa Rica, let's go back to the article in Costa Rica's La Nación. It says, to put this in perspective, even though Costa Rica has 3 times the economic activity of Guatemala and Paraguay, the 2 Latin countries they're tied with on the bad road list, he says it's due to Costa Rica's limited investment in infrastructure. You think? It goes on to say there are many factors involved. 1, corruption. 2, a very deep lack of planning skills. And 3, poor preparation of infrastructure projects and limited vision. Oh, and get this. The report says throughout Latin America, cargo travels by truck 4 times slower than the world average. That, according to Jamie Granados from the Inter-American Development Bank. He explains, quote, the rate of passage of cargo and transport units throughout the corridors of Central and South America is very slow, around 15 to 16 kilometers per hour on average. Whereas in the developed world, the U.S., Australia, Canada, and Europe, freight haulers on average move from 50 to 70 kilometers per hour. That, he says, coupled with the fact that in Latin America, when truck drivers stop at borders, it takes 3 to 4 times as long as the world average due to excess paperwork and bureaucracy. All right, so that just reinforces what we already knew, right? Traffic in Latin America sucks, and you don't want to drive if you don't have to. But even if you don't drive, you will be on the road at times, so don't get angry. It does no good. Take a pill. You'll live longer. On second thought, don't take a pill. You'll live longer. Oh, and it might be a good idea to refer back to my last show where I explain what kind of car you need to drive if you're going to drive in Latin America. All right, changing gears, no pun intended. Here's a cool email from an 80-year-old guy. It's from Mallory, like the battery. Don't think they have Mallory batteries anymore, do they? Anyway, he says, Johnny, I got my plan B in action. I'm moving to Latin America. Yes, I'm 80, but better late than never. He said, I'm tired of watching the U.S. commit suicide in slow motion. And Johnny, I'm with you when you say it's no use to vote. Remember Einstein's definition of insanity? He said, repeating the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. That's insanity. I've come to see in my 80 years of life that's exactly what voting's all about. Going into that booth over and over again, pulling a lever and expecting a different result. It's like going to a Godzilla movie and expecting Mothra to kick his ass. It's just not going to happen. Godzilla always wins. After all, the name of the movie's Godzilla, not Mothra. But we still keep going to see the remakes over and over, hoping Mothra will kick his ass, and he never will. And Johnny, I know at 80 years old, I don't have many years left. It's just that lately I've been having this little conversation in my head about regrets. For me, it's kind of a depressing experience. I remember I had that same conversation with myself when I was around 50 years old, and sure, even back then I had plenty of regrets. I thought about trying new things, made plans, but in the end didn't do anything about it. I was too firmly in debt and glued to my treadmill. And you know what, Johnny? Unfortunately, the regrets I had when I was 50 are the same ones I have now that I'm 80. Number 1, I regret the things I was afraid to do. Number 2, I regret the things I was afraid to try. And number 3, I regret the relationships I was afraid to pursue. Yeah, for sure, those are unmanly things to admit to people when you're 50. But when you're 80, who gives a shit? I figure I got one more chapter left in my life, even if it's a short one. I'm going to live it in Latin America. By the way, Johnny, I was one of those Peace Corps characters in the 60s, so I had been to 3 or 4 countries in Latin America, and I loved it. That was way back when you couldn't even make a phone call from your room. You had to go down to the hotel desk. So that's number one on my 80-year-old bucket list of no regrets, writing my last chapter from Latin America. I started my Plan B project last year. The first step was to cut all the a-holes out of my life. Best thing I ever did. I'm not saying it doesn't hurt for a minute when you confront the negative jerks in your life and tell them you're going to cut them off, socially and financially. But talk about a load of weight off your shoulders, man. The guy who said you can't pick your relatives, he got that right. But I am taking some heat. Just the mention of abandoning California for Latin America irks some of the people around me. I agree, they should be pissed. Oh, but what a bad father I am. What a shame my 2 40-something-year-old kids will have to stand on their own 2 feet. What a concept. Though I'm not ungrateful at all for having been born in the U.S. and living the good life when I was a young guy. When I was in my 20s, going to college, getting on my feet myself, the country wasn't perfect. Nothing's perfect. People would talk about things they didn't like about certain politicians, or they'd read about bad things in the paper. But back then, no one ever talked about the whole country going into the crapper. That was inconceivable, but now we're swirling around the bowl and going down the drain. And all this make America great BS. I was just looking at a Gallup work poll. Did you ever hear of that one? Got it right in front of me. It says, in 2018, Gallup took a poll of 30,000 people living in the U.S. and Europe, asking them a number of questions about their work and how they felt about their jobs. Here's the results. 13% of people, 13%, like their work and look forward to going to it. And fully 80% of that 13% of those people who liked their jobs were small business owners. What does that tell you? The overwhelming majority of people who like their jobs own their own businesses. And there's more news from the Gallup work poll. I'll read on. It says, fully 63% of people are doing what they call, quote, sleepworking. Do you know what sleepworking is, Johnny? I didn't. Well, they explain it as people who don't like their job, they just tolerate it. And in the minutes and hours before they're supposed to show up, they think about how they'd rather be doing almost anything else. They just don't look forward to work. Then the poll says 24% of those 30,000 people polled say that though they hate their jobs, they don't want to lose or quit that job, fearing the next job could be even worse. That means 87% of people don't like the thing they are stuck doing for 30 or 40 years of their lives. Then it says 81% of the people polled don't like Sunday afternoons or Sunday nights. It's called Sunday anxiety blues. For most people, it starts around 3 in the afternoon. It's because people realize subconsciously that the next day they'll be jumping on that treadmill again. Johnny, I was one of those guys. However, on the plus side, I do have a pension of $2,500 a month. I hope that allows me to lead a decent life in Latin America. Because year after year, I'm losing ground here in Southern California. I've heard you say on your show $1,500 to $2,000 a month for a single person would be just fine. I'm going to hold you to that, Johnny. I'm also going to sign up for your July seminar. That is, if you allow 80-year-old guys to attend. I am in pretty good health. I only take blood pressure pills. You just have to let me know when I can sign up and how to do it. Hope to see you this summer. Mallory from Pasadena. All right. Thanks for that, Mal. By the way, I've had people of all ages attend my Expat Insider seminars. Youngest attendee, 18-year-old guy. He came alone, too. My oldest attendee, an 84-year-old lady, an injectable diabetic with a knee replacement. She got around just fine and, in fact, loved the seminar so much, she wants to come back as a repeat offender, even though now she's 87. So, Mal, the age spread for my seminar is all over the map. There have been plenty of 50 and 60-somethings and plenty of 20-somethings, too. By the way, this particular Expat File show comes out on Sunday, March 31st. And by Monday, the 1st of April, you'll be able to see all the seminar information and sign-up sheet by going to www.thenewexpat.com and clicking on Johnny's seminar link. So again, the next seminar is in Central America, Guatemala, and El Salvador. It starts Saturday, July 6th and ends Thursday night, July 11th. And if you're a working person coming down from the States, you'll have Friday, July 5th off as part of that long 4th of July weekend. So Friday, July 5th would be a great day, a no-brainer day, to fly in. Though a lot of people come in a couple of days before the seminar because they have certain things to do. Check out dentists, physicians, insurance plans, cars, land, residency, any number of things. And of course, our expat concierge ladies will help you with all that. And if you plan on killing two birds with one stone, that is coming to the seminar and applying for temporary or permanent residency in Guatemala, you'll have to stay another week right after the seminar to get all the paperwork and the signatures done. But for full details and the answers to all your questions, go to thenewexpat.com and click on Johnny's seminar link. Oh, and don't forget, if you sign up now, you'll get in on the early bird discounts. That should last another month or so, and after that, prices go up $500 a person. So, get in on the discounts now. Plus, when you sign up, you'll get a free one-hour Skype or phone consultation with me. We'll talk about anything you need to talk about regarding the seminar, your own plan B, or anything. All right, now this quick email from Sally. She says, Johnny, in listening to your previous show analysis of cell phones in Latin America, I have an idea of why those caravans are coming up through Mexico. I noticed every time there's an on-the-spot reporter or a camera crew, all the teenagers and adults in that caravan have a smartphone. Yes, even dirt-poor immigrants on the move who've abandoned their country and have given up everything have smartphones. Johnny, I'm not saying it's their fault. I'm saying it's one of the diseases of humanity, that all luxuries soon enough become necessities. That is, luxuries become necessities till they reach a point we can't live without them. And some people will do heroic things, for example, pick up everything and leave their countries just to obtain things that didn't even exist a few years back. Keep up the good fight, Johnny. Sally from New Brunswick. Another Canuck. Hey there. All right, now, here's something cool. Wish I'd have thought of it. I was talking to a couple of expat gringo mom-and-pop hotel owners right on the beach. And you know, it's a funny thing. You can often distinguish if a gringo or a local Latino owns a mom-and-pop hotel or bar restaurant on the beach. Because, you see, it's almost always the case, the beachfront is much cleaner, in fact, sometimes nicely manicured, when a gringo, European, or expat owns it. And when a Latino owns it, well, you know why they call it the third world, right? Details, details. I mean, lack thereof. So anyway, just recently I was sitting with a gringo buddy on the beach at a little restaurant owned by a gringo expat couple. And on either side there were properties, businesses, owned by Latinos. But their beachfront was just as clean and manicured as the gringo's site. And I thought, that's unusual. I said, how'd that happen? Last time I was here, yours was the only nicely manicured beach without any litter or trash. And on either side, how'd you get your Latino neighbors to fall in line? He said, every other Sunday morning, we got a clean the beachfront program going, and the locals are really pitching in. I said, the locals? Really? How long you think that's going to last? What's the incentive? He said, oh, there's plenty of incentive. You see, we give a free drink to everyone who brings in a bag of beach litter. We hand out the bags. They have to be our bags. He said, first week, he had guys going home and emptying out their own garbage to get a free drink. Can't have that, you know. He said, we have to keep an eye out. When it comes to giving out free stuff, humans are sneaky, you know. Then I said, good idea, though you might go broke. He said, nah, we got something like 7 or 8 gringo businesses in on this, so we rotate. My turn for the free drinks is something like every 2 months, so no biggie. Besides, he said, almost all of them will have a beer. You'd be surprised, Johnny, how many backpacking gringos and surfer gringo types get in on the action, too. I don't know if their motivation's for a clean beach or free drinks. Oh, and you ask about going broke. Well, the first 2 times we ran that thing, man, we thought we were going to go broke. Lots of trash came in. Too much trash. Kind of scared me. But after that, the pickings weren't so easy, and that's why the beach is looking so good. Good news, right? Talk about gringo ingenuity. You find out when you live in a third world culture and locals don't give a poop about their own environment, you need real incentives, basic incentives, like free beer. Which brings us to our next topic, Nicaragua. Man, do I get emails about Nicaragua. People saying, what in the hell is happening over there? Yep, I know lots of gringos and expats who've set up shop there in the past few years. And a lot of gringos and expats have come from Costa Rica because it's way too expensive. And they say, hey, if I don't get the hell out now, I'll never be able to afford this place. With Nicaragua being the natural choice since it shares a border with Costa Rica. You'll find if you're in Costa Rica, there are tons of Nicaraguans there doing the menial, tough, and manual labor jobs. And if you know any of them and talk to them, they'll always tell you that Nicaragua's about 50% cheaper than living in Costa Rica. And they're right. Now, you longtime listeners know I've never been big on Nicaragua. I never gave it the thumbs up simply because of this Sandinista problem. Daniel Ortega's in charge, and he's a well-known murderer, communist, psychopath, dictator. Other than that, he's a pretty nice guy. Oh, and don't forget he's a pedophile, too. Which brings me to this email from Benjamin, a previous Expat Insider seminar attendee who ended up living in Nicaragua. He says, Johnny, I've been living in Nicaragua for 4 years now. The first couple of years were great. However, since gringos, especially gringos who don't speak Spanish, rarely mix with the locals or know the local politics, you don't find out things until it's too late. Like, for example, I found out that something like 85% of the country are registered Sandinistas. And even a couple of years back, people would never say a bad word about Ortega. And if you were another gringo, Canadian, or European brought up the Sandinista wars in connection, if you were around local Nicaraguans, you'd find yourself in a one-sided conversation with no one else contributing a thing. It seemed awful strange that there was no general outspoken distrust for government, like you see in every other Latin country except for Venezuela and Cuba. The Nicaraguans I know just completely avoid talking politics. Though one thing I'll give Ortega, he made Nicaragua safe compared to the rest of Central America. There's almost no organized gang activity going on. But because he has such tight-fisted control of the police and the military, he'll never let go of power. Now I know why citizens can't own guns in Nicaragua. Used to think that was a good thing, but not anymore. The problem is, Johnny, when all of us gringos and expats moved to Nicaragua, whether it was from International Living magazine promoting it as one of the top retirement destinations for gringos and expats, or the fact that so many gringos and expats moved from Costa Rica to Nicaragua because it was so much cheaper, the problem is nearly all of us gringos and expats moved without knowing the basic history of the country. Like, for example, how in 1979 the Sandinistas came to power with the help and support of Jimmy Carter. And they were communists of the most extreme faction. In fact, many kids and adolescents in Nicaragua carry the names of Soviet communist heroes. History shows the Sandinistas killed more than 100,000 people from 1979 to 1990. Then Reagan, who was truly a flawed president too, armed the Contras, who ousted the Sandinistas. Yet another sordid chapter in U.S. history. Unfortunately, the Contras did not hang the Sandinistas who'd done all the killing, because the new president, Violeta Chamorro, had a daughter who was a Sandinista. That contributed to the fact that most Sandinistas received amnesty. Meanwhile, Daniel Ortega continued governing the country without being actual president. And in 2008, he took over again. Little by little, he began exterminating farmers, peasants, and protesters in the countryside. At least these days, the world is hearing about the students that are dying because of their protests. So far in this round, there are a few hundred dead and many more injured and counting. Which brings me back to one of the very first things Ortega did when he took over. He disarmed the population. Doesn't that sound familiar? All right, changing gears, we've got some sad news for Canadians and why they definitely have to get that Plan B going and get the hell out of Dodge, or the Canadian version of Cleveland, whatever. Let me paraphrase from this article that just came out, entitled, Canadian Government Will Now Begin Tracking Travelers to Verify Their Status. It starts out, later this year, Canada will start collecting data on every person leaving Canada by land or air in a bid to identify and track anyone from potential terrorists to tax evaders to snowbirds and people who lie about their residency to claim government benefits. Then it says, it is not known how many people they will catch in this net, but both Employment and Social Development Departments and Canada Revenue will have access to all this data and are expected to nab thousands of Canadians who are outside of the country who are ineligible to receive government payments. For example, national health care benefits and private or public pensions. Then it says, and listen to this carefully, Canadians, of special interest here are Canadians who live part-time or full-time in such popular expatriate destinations as Mexico, Panama, Ecuador, Costa Rica, and Colombia. Then it says, the Canadian Snowbird Association, didn't even know they had one, has been following the exit control changes closely and warns its 100,000 members against breaking immigration laws by overstaying beyond the six-month limit and risking the loss of their federal benefits such as old age security, national health care benefits, and guaranteed income supplements. Then it says, Canadian Border Services agencies do not currently collect exit information from commercial air carriers on travelers, and for now only has access to U.S. records of foreign nationals and Canadian permanent residents arriving from Canada at land ports of entry. This will change later this year. The new reporting scheme, it says, is a final phase of what's known as the Entry-Exit Initiative for Canada, which will allow Canadian officials to track 97% to 99% of all the outbound travelers who leave the country by land and air. The effort will be expanded soon to travel by rail and sea. They'll be collecting land exit data starting this summer, followed by air travel data by the end of the year. What Canadian travelers don't seem to understand, say immigration policy analysts, is that by being Canadian, you're consenting to have all of your personal information donated to other countries such as the USA and dozens of other countries due to the many information sharing agreements Canada has participated in. Canadian officials in Ottawa are saying they'll be able to, number one, identify outbound travelers who are known risks. Number two, track visitors who overstay their visa and remain in Canada illegally. Number three, verify travel dates to assess applicable duties, taxes, and benefits for returning residents. And number four, check if permanent residents returning to Canada have fulfilled their physical residency requirements to maintain their status and still qualify for various benefits. Once fully implemented, the law states that your personal information will be retained by Canada for 15 years. Surprised? Shouldn't be. So what's to be said about that? Hey there, how's that Plan B coming?
You've been listening to the Expat Files Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy. Nos vemos!